Start the tape, please. This is Friday, the 16th of August, 1991. It says in my calendar, anyway. I'm Peter Nash, and this is the fourth of five Bible studies on the Advent lessons for the coming church year, for Advent C. For those of you who haven't been here before, the material that I'm using is material that I wrote for the ELCA in a little booklet they'll be putting out on preaching peace, justice, and care of the earth from the lectionary for year C. I had a fine voice just 10 minutes ago. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Dear God, teach us to hear the voices you set in the wildernesses of our lives. Let us discern your word in these voices when they come from afar or in strange forms. And when our time comes to speak from the wilderness, strengthen us to speak your truth. These things we ask in the name of your Son. Amen. Amen. Yeah, that's better. Let me read. John comes from the wilderness preaching in the spirit of the prophets. We often choose to ignore him or treat him as a minor player, a mere introductory straw man for the real gospel message delivered in the words of Jesus. John and the prophets before him are not shills for the real argument of the gospel. They are the background that gives Jesus' words texture and reality. They point out the fact that the Christ child arrives to really free us from something quite vile, ourselves. The exhortations of John the Baptist are listed as part of the good news, or at the very least intertwined with it. No extortion, no unjust taxes. Whoever has two coats must share with the one who has none. Whoever has food must share with the one who has none. In the pericope for the second Sunday in Advent, from Malachi, like John, announces the coming of a new age with a reminder of the old. Salvation and justice are inseparable. Those who come for baptism hoping to receive salvation and justice without abandoning their own part in injustice and oppression are disappointed by John's words. And he informs them that the Messianic age would be likewise disappointing. The Messiah does not come to confirm humanity's devices for self-deception, but to free us from our constant desire to lord ourselves over our fellow travelers. Certainly, John allows tax collectors and soldiers to do their jobs. Everyone needs clothing sufficient to protect him or her from the weather. But to have more than what is sufficient while another is in want denies our partner salvation, and in doing so, we deny ourselves salvation. We might point out that it is not just to require us to give up what we have earned for the sake of the one who has not earned as well. John reminds us of the prophetic and Deuteronomic tradition that asserts that even though we till the soil and harvest the crops, to use their images, all that we have is on loan from God, who is the owner of all things. This does run counter to our idea that everyone should earn what he or she can and suffer the consequences of the failure to do so. Our prophetic tradition reminds us that those who cannot work are included in God's covenant. This is as true of those whom we cannot see as it is of those who are in our midst. Christ's universal effectiveness and the technological shrinking of our world Make it impossible to continue to pretend that the poor of the world are not our fellow travelers. In the Captain America complex, Robert Jewett traces the American tradition of deserved blessing through the preaching of the church in the 18th and 19th century. Can anything run more counter to the teaching of grace alone than the idea that hard work brings about God's favor? I think not. John offers the opportunity to look forward to the Messianic age with renewed hope. Hope not only to be freed of our own oppressions and the injustices we suffer, but also to be freed from the role of oppressor and the injustices which we inflict upon others. Any questions or comments about that so far? Two points that I want to get at today. One is that, as you heard in this little piece that I've written, is that John the Baptist is not a straw man. He comes square out of the prophetic tradition and speaks the good news, speaks a word of salvation to us. And that these people often come from places that we don't expect to hear the good news. And it comes in strange forms. The other is that we might be the voice from the wilderness. And in fact, I am sure that we are the voice from the wilderness, not only in this Holden community, but in every, in the literal wilderness, but in the wildernesses that we as humanity have created for ourselves. Now that I've, I hope, colored your opinion of this text, let's take a look at it. Let's actually start at Luke chapter 3, verse 4, just so we get some good Old Testament material quoted here. Mm-hmm. Someone start this for me.
4?
Yeah, not maybe that 4 through 14.
As it is written in the book of the words of Isaiah the prophet, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his path straight. Every valley shall be filled, and every mountain and hill shall be brought low, and the crooked shall be made straight, and the rough ways shall be made smooth, and all flesh shall see the salvation of God. He said, therefore, to the multitudes that came out to be baptized by him, you brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come? Bear fruits that befit repentance, and do not begin to say to yourselves, we have Abraham as our father. For I tell you, God is able from these stones to raise up children to Abraham. Even now the axe is laid to the root of the trees. Every tree, therefore, that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. And the multitudes asked him, what then shall we do? And he answered them, he who has two coats, let him share with him who has none. And he who has food, let him do likewise. Tax collectors also came to be baptized and said to him, teacher, what shall we do? And he said to them, collect no more than is appointed you. Soldiers also asked him, and we, what shall we do? And he said to them, rob no one by violence or by false accusation, and be content with your wages.
Thank you. Someone, take us to the end of this passage and we'll come back and I'll ask some questions and you can start asking me questions.
And the people were in expectation, and all men mused in their hearts of John, whether he were the Christ or not. John answered, saying unto them all, I indeed baptize you with water, but one mightier than I cometh, the latchet of whose shoes I am not worthy to unloose. He shall baptize you with the Holy Ghost and with fire, whose fan is in his hand, and he will thoroughly purge his floor, and will gather the wheat into his garner, but the chaff he will burn with fire unquenchable. And many other things in his exhortation preached he unto the people.
Read one more verse from me.
But Herod the Tetrarch, being reproved by him for Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, and for all the evils that Herod had done, added yet this above all, that he shut up John in prison.
Thank you. Keep these things in mind. Some questions about John. When you think of John, what do you think of? Do you think of John?
As a prophet.
As a prophet?
Beheaded.
Who lost his head? Yeah. There are problems with preaching, aren't there? Or with prophesying.
Quite strong views.
A strong ego, a strong self-esteem that he could speak out and not care what people around him thought.
Okay. Very clear, again, an opinion and confidence that what he was saying was what he is called to say, what his task is, and the rest of the world, excuse the pun, be damned. How do you think of him relative to Jesus?
I think of John as a wild man, and I think of Jesus as a little more tame.
Okay.
Opposite extremes.
Okay. Opposite extremes?
Kind and gentle and gruff and, you know.
Kind and gentle and gruff and which one is which?
Jesus is kind and gentle, John is the other extreme, kind of gruff and, you know, speaks loudly and forcefully, and Jesus is kind and soft-spoken.
Yeah. Okay. When you speak of the wild man and the little more tame, you're kind of talking out of those archetypes, aren't you? Or are you?
Well, now that you mention it.
Okay. This is the picture that I often come to, both of these comments of John is wild and gruff and also a guy I probably wouldn't want living next door to me. And Jesus is sort of a really nice guy who gives me all sorts of good news while John gives me bad news. But let's go back and read this verse 18. So with many other exhortations, he preached good news to the people. What I heard there wasn't, you know, I don't want to hear about the unquenchable fire. It didn't strike me as particularly good news. But I really want to try to drive home this point that John is part of the good news. I have a tendency, and I think the church has, and I think I learned it from the church, to think of John as bad news just so we'll be able, so we'll be set up for the good news that comes in Jesus. But I don't think the text allows us really to see it that way. That John in fact is a part of the good news. That all of these changes that he's talking about the separating of the wheat and the chaff, is part of the good news. Any farmers here before I speak about that, which I do not know, I don't want anybody to correct me on that. Make this mistake. No farmers, no former farmers, I can speak freely.
My little kid who was on the farm but wasn't wanting to get off of it in a hurry.
you knew one?
Anything is okay with me.
Well, actually, there was a real farm person in the first audience, so I did get my information straight. The wheat and the chaff, when you separate this stuff out, you have a whole lot more chaff than you have wheat. You have a much bigger pile of chaff than you have wheat, and that's the stuff that's going to get burned. And that really is kind of frightening news. But, So how does it get to be good news? How do we deal with this passage that in, I mean, gosh, the Bible tells us that this is good news. How do we understand it that way? How can we get there? Well, we'll go through some other stuff. And yes?
When I made my comment about John, I didn't think that he preached nothing, you know, that bad news. I've always thought of him as preaching good news, but it's his manner that I kind of, it's his you know, really decisive, bold, rough manner.
Yeah, certainly in manner. Then I'll let you answer the question then. What is the good news here of this guy who's telling us that the majority of the audience, I mean, he starts off in 7, in the text where he said, therefore to the multitude that came out to be baptized, you brood of vipers. Yeah. Well, what would happen, how many people would come back tomorrow if I started my Bible studies that way? You brood of vipers.
All of them. He does say in his sermon, if there is bad news, he does explain the possibility for what new life will be in the sermon. I can't quote it, but the idea of what, you know, so what should we do? And he doesn't say, I can't tell you that. He says, you know, this is what you do. And it's not an impossible task. And then he goes on in the sermon then to describe the one that will come and do more for us yet, so that it's not, this is just the end of the journey here, but let me tell you how to live, and there's one yet to come who will carry on and show us even more. Yeah. So I think, you know, that's good news.
Yeah.
Bad news would be just, you brood of vipers, and whatever that phrase about cutting down the tree, and that's it.
Yeah. I want you to note here, if you have this disease that I have, that John is the bad guy and Jesus is the good guy, who's the one who's got the axe? Who's going to separate the wheat from the chaff? Who's got the axe? And who's going to do the burning? I just want us to...
Another image that I have about with John and Jesus and good news would be their birth stories. Because I think the idea of John leaping in the womb is a, you know, that's not a gruffness, that's a delight, that's a joy.
How did such a happy baby...
News. Really, what?
Get to be this guy. Yeah.
His dad was a priest or a preacher.
Oh no.
That's what happened.
another PK. Huh?
Yes.
That story is important. I asked, and it was kind of a pun, but nobody picked up on it, and that's not unusual for me. What do you think of John relative to Jesus? And they were cousins, and they met each other in utero, so to speak, and John leapt. And his mother Elizabeth knew it. That was where the human annunciation came in. Pardon?
I'm just confessing our ignorance. That's all.
Well, believe me, you're not alone. But in my case, when it comes, I get real scared when I find myself forced to speak of the New Testament. Not that I don't find myself a competent pastor, but I just feel so much more competent than the Hebrew Scriptures. He really is not the straw man that you may hear him set up, or maybe tempted to set him up in your mind as. He is part of the good news, and as what is your name?
Cindy.
As Cindy says, that he's getting us, he's helping us get ready for this and avoid this terrible judgment. He's teaching us how to complete the salvation that God gives us. And he does it, again, in the line of the prophets. The prophets come telling people, God has given you a gift, and you've made the mistake of thinking of it as your own. God has made a loan to you, maybe is a better way to think of it, and you've made the mistake of thinking that it's your own stuff, and you've kept it away from other folk. John's going to let there be soldiers. You know, some of us want to do away with soldiers altogether. Well, John says, no, soldiers just don't rob and extort. Unfortunately, a lot of what we do with our military in every nation in the history of the world is use them to rob and extort in an organized manner from other nations. But make no false accusations down in verse 14. Tax collectors, remember the tradition, well, first, let me finish with the soldiers. Soldiers were the oppressors, the Roman soldiers who came in and so not only subdued the whole nation, but also in doing so went a step further and illegally extorted through violence. Tax collectors were the internal oppressors, contractors, often Jews themselves, who they come along to Verlon and say, you made $200,000 last year, Rome wants 100 of it. And instead of saying Rome wants 100 of it, they'd say Rome wants 110 of it. Pastor is up at Holden, get paid quite well, as you all know. And of course, that extra $10,000 would go right into the tax collector's pocket and he'd ship the rest of it along. Or he may even lie to Rome and say, well, Pastor Verlon only made $190,000 last year, and then send the tax back on that amount. At any rate, they were pretty crooked guys, taking more than they were legally allowed to by virtue of their office and being representatives of Rome. So they were sort of doubly traitors. Those things can't happen. You know, those are sort of the gross examples. Those are the very clear examples. And these guys were in the crowd, don't forget. You know, these people came out to be baptized, seeking salvation. And they said, well, yeah, there's salvation here for you, but this is what you've got to know about how it works. You can't just get the monkey off of your back unless you take your monkey off of someone else's back. You can't have a clean back if you've got monkeys on other people's backs. And it's not only with these guys who are such gross violators. Those aren't the only cases. There's this sort of unconscious violations of others. If you've got two coats, well, how many can you wear at a time? If you've got two coats and you can only wear one at a time, and you know that somebody else doesn't have any coat, then you got to give them your other coat. You got to give them the extra coat. Just have to. Otherwise, everybody's in trouble. If you've got enough to eat and then a closet full, a pantry full, and you know that there's somebody else that doesn't have enough to eat, you just have to give it to them. I mean, that's how you're, you know, we tend to think of it as that's how they're going to be saved, at least in the material realm. But what John is telling us is that's how we're going to be saved. That's how salvation comes to us. When we're not so dragged down with all of this stuff, this sense of security that what I've got in my pantry is what's going to keep me going, is what is my lifeblood. Sure, have enough to eat, but don't have so much to eat when somebody else is looking just to have enough, just to feed their kids or just to feed themselves.
It's sort of a nagging conscience.
John? Yeah. Very, very much a nagging conscience. But he presents, he continues to present to us this picture of this all being gifted, that it doesn't belong to us. It's on loan. And it's on loan to everyone, and by some accident or luck, more of it ended up in our pantry or in our closet than in somebody else's. But what we tend to do and what becomes a block to salvation is the belief that I earned those four suits in my closet. You know, those are mine. I mean, I'm a professor. I have to look like I have authority when I step in front of my classroom. Otherwise, they won't believe a word I say. Imagine that. I think I told this story when we sent our little letter to the president, our fax to the president before the war started, or before the war was an actual bombing war. And as the faculty finished up things, finished up this little fax to the president, they said, the last line was, "We urge you to work for a quick and just peace in the Iraq-Kuwait situation." And I said, "I can't sign this. I have two cars. You know, I'm not sure I want justice in this case. I mean, I only live 3 miles from where I work. My wife lives next door to where she works. So I wasn't sure how much I really wanted justice in this matter of oil and oil use and petroleum products. It's a real striking example to me. I said it as a joke, but I knew that there's a mark of seriousness about it. We can't continue to own even ourselves, and that is problematic in this good news for us, for me. But it is the good news that I'm not encumbered. I don't need to be encumbered by it. Anybody have any comments on this or questions?
Well, I think, you know, the idea of you having two cars isn't so terrible. I mean, you need your car to go where you need to go. Your wife needs her car to go where she goes. But I think when you have maybe five or six cars, mm-hmm. you know, when you get such an abundance of things and don't share, so naturally others are going to be without.
Yeah.
Little, you know, extras are not so terrible.
No, I don't think that. I agree. I don't think a little extra is so terrible. But like I said, my wife works next door to lives. We're in a parsonage, and she walks not even 100 yards to work, and I'm 3 miles, 4 miles from work. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this, but but when around the world there are people who walk 3 and 4 miles just to get a drink of water, the water for today, for that day, or for that morning, and they walk that far to get their water back and forth, and because they can't get a gas-driven pump into the area because it costs too much to buy gas there because it's so cheap. What I don't want to do is fall down on my knees and say, "Oh God, I thank you that I'm not like the guy next door who has three cars, one of which is a 1960 Corvette in mint condition." I'm not sure that there's such a gap in our existence. I mean, he has a lot more than I do, but I have a lot more than most people, and I'm not the best at redistributing it. Yeah.
I remember a lot of times, particularly in the 60s, when after African Americans would tell their stories, and whites would ask, "What can we do?" Maybe women would tell their stories, and men would ask, "What could we do?" This kind of seems like something we can do. Does it seem that way to you? I mean, does it seem like a kind of, I hate to use the word format, but sort of guidelines for what we can do?
In this text here?
Yeah. You mean?
Oh, absolutely. But I think the question is how we do it. Vernon and I went to college together, and remember when Bob Holst was getting us ready to go down to Jamaica and told us the story of the pastor with whom we would be staying, how he got a car for his job, and he read a passage like this one, and then sold his car and gave all his money away, and then couldn't do his job. I don't want us to blindly go out and say the text says only have one coat. I can't do all of my job with one coat, but I do have to ask the question: how much of it do I need, and how much of it do I take just because I can take it, by virtue of where I live and the kind of paycheck I get? Yes, back here.
Maybe distribution isn't our job. maybe we should leave that job. I mean, if we see someone in need and we have excess, yes, we should share. But if you give away your car and somebody over in Africa needs a car, he isn't going to get your car.
Probably not. Yeah, or if he does, he can't pay the delivery charges. Yeah. But you know, if I really become convicted of this particular excess, it is possible that I could sell my car and send the, you know, whatever comes from that to the global missions, designated as a designated gift, or UMCOR, or through some organization that I know. And I mean, that, and that's where the hard work comes in, is to find out who's really going to get this to where it needs to be used. And there are, it makes it possible for us to make some really intelligent decisions about where we're going to put our money. I far be it for me to suggest that we don't plan adequately for retirement, because the way our society is structured now, I have to be concerned about who's going to take care of me when I'm retired? How I'm going to live when I'm retired? Everybody has that responsibility, for no other reason than not to become another lump on the system that just, you know, collects. But then it's, you know, how do we do that? Who's, you know, if we're doing our own stuff, if we're not, you know, kind of simply pushing money into our company's retirement fund, but we're buying stocks and buying property, then we're obliged to ask the question, well, how's the property being managed? Who, you know, where is this company investing? How are they using the resources? How are they replenishing the resources? We can ask those questions and get reasonable answers in this country. And so I think we're obliged to do it.
Yeah, you said let God do the distribution. In the cases, that's exactly what the prophet is saying has been done. And God did distribute things. And Genesis says it was good. So God's already done that. God's done what God always does. And so it's our sin that it is misdistributed.
Right.
And so God calls us to repent of that and say, hey, I already did this. I already distributed things. And it's because of your sin that it's now misdistributed. And now the prophet, John, and the prophets in the Old Testament say, this is what happens when what God has done is good, and when you change that, this is what it will cost you.
Well, I guess I'm thinking of, like, some of our organizations distribute food overseas, mm-hmm. or something, and then there's a war, and they're not able to deliver the things that they have bought. Now, this is out of our hands, and God has a reason for doing these things, I believe. And someone else gets the benefit, or he uses it for a different purpose.
Yeah, or it's
I'm not saying we shouldn't give to those things, mm-hmm. but if they don't work out the way
we
plan,
that isn't necessarily our fault either.
Yeah, yeah, I agree that some of it, but I would love to see what would happen if at some point our government we intervene in other people's governances. We do, and we sometimes do it overtly, as we did in Iraq and in the Kuwait mess, and we sometimes do it covertly through supporting. I mean, we were in an absolutely absurd situation where we were in Angola, where we were supporting Cuban-trained guerrillas to protect American oil fields from freedom fighters. It was just a bizarre situation. But that's where our money was going. I would love to see what would happen if the United States government would at one point, or any government would at one point, say, there's a civil war going on in Somalia or Ethiopia, and they're using food as a weapon. We won't stand for that. And we go in with some troops there and say, we're going to get food to these people because they will die otherwise. You know, sort of a fantastic vision, but you know, we've got all this power, we've got all this wealth, but we don't use it that way. We use it to protect our interests, which is what our government is charged with doing. I don't want to come off as if I don't think that's important, but that's That's George's first job, is to protect American interest.
It would be so hard to do just what you said, though, because it's just not that simple. It doesn't seem. It seems like as soon as we're over there to get that food to those people, then to do that, we're going to have to kill some other people and on. And it just, it's...
Yeah. And I understand that it is not simple, but it was not simple on January 15th. It was not simple then. We talked about it as if it were simple. We had one enemy in the whole country of Iraq. We have no quarrel with the people of Iraq, right? I mean, that's what we said as the president, as our representative. Hundreds of, 100,000 people at least, maybe hundreds of thousands of people killed, not one of them named Saddam Hussein. Right? I mean, our objective was to stop his terror. This guy is with the exception of the fact that his military is pretty much wrecked, but not as wrecked as we said in February and March. This guy still runs things tighter in Iraq now than he did then. There he's out of Kuwait, but there's no democracy in Kuwait. Nowhere near democracy in Kuwait. We're willing to do it for the oil, but we're not willing to do it to make sure that people eat.
But if we did it to make sure that people ate, I wonder if we still, no matter what the reason was, I wonder if we still at times wouldn't end up in such a mess.
Oh, I'm sure that we would. You I'm know, absolutely the, sure that
the,
we
the,
would.
The reason would be better, but the world actually wouldn't be that much better off in some cases. Maybe there's still innocent people that are going to die because of that.
To own and to have. And the belief that what has been, the bounty that has been showered on this world and for this, you know, 210 years, 214 years now, this section of the world, which we are lucky, most of us are lucky enough to have been born into, and it's just dumb luck. I mean, none of us, I don't think any of us get to check off Soviet Union, U.S. I think the U.S. would be a nice place to be born, but maybe Angola would be nice too. I think it's just dumb luck that we end up here on this continent rather than on another one where more people are starving. And we have to own that it's just a gift. And we're charged with distribution. We are charged with distribution in the prophets, in the gospel here in John and in the prophets. And we'll look at some of those passages from the prophets in a minute. Yeah.
I just think it would be kind of interesting what would happen to the psyche of the country if we went to war for fair distribution rather than, like you said, going to war to make sure that we got ours. Are all of our motives for getting in these crazy political situations was to make sure that other people got food. I mean, according to the scripture that you just read, if we were about that, I wonder what difference that would make.
Why don't we consider that our interest as much as having one of
them? Well, yeah, and that's one of the things I want to get us to be arguing about today, or I want to present today, is that it is our interest. Paul Hansen has been arguing that there is a national soul. So it's easy to see in the Israelite tradition that there's a national soul, and that if one suffers, we all suffer. If one is out of sync, we're all out of sync. If the worship isn't pure and it doesn't lead to right actions, we're all in trouble. And we see that over and over again in our social system here in the States. That, you know, if we look at a child and say, you're not my child, or you're not my child, but you're not only not my child, but you're not from my clan, so to speak, clan with a C. Please don't read more into this than I'm saying. Then I'm not going to take care of you. If we refuse to spend $10 there, we wind up, when this guy is 21, spending $150 on it.
That's right. I was just thinking, I mean, we were talking about having a war just to feed other people. Well, it wouldn't take a war to feed and house Americans. You know, it's just that there's no profit in it.
I bet you it would take a war.
Take a war?
To feed and house all Americans? I think it would.
To our own people? You mean there'd be a war if we started to sort of feed everybody and house them?
It's a verbal war right now, really. You know, we keep telling them the same thing, but they don't seem to be listening.
For the most part, unintentionally, many of us have a vested interest in there being some hungry people. Otherwise, with all of the media that we have, and as controlled as Paul Hansen claims that it is, with all that we see about the homeless, how can we still have homeless in this country? It's not just that these people don't want to work. Yeah. Am I willing to make $10,000 a year less? Let's take the three of us. Right? Are we willing to make $10,000 a year less, each of us, so that Verlon is already over there? You know, Verlon now is not making $200,000 a year as pastor, but is making nothing. Are we willing to work less so that he can have a job? You know, work less and make less, live in a smaller house, eat less rich food, so that he can work. And I grew up in Michigan where unions are real strong, and it wouldn't just be a verbal war. You know, who lives in Minnesota and watched all this Hormel stuff? I mean, that was remnants of the 30s and strike breakers and virtual military intervention to make sure that people got in and out safely and or not safely. Well, all kinds of intimidation.
That's exactly why socialism has collapsed in East Germany. You know, there are a certain percentage of people who just didn't bother. 8-hour day, if I only go home for 6 hours, I go home. Nothing was quality. You know, the whole government was supposed to give you everything. You got education and you got a job, you got a place to live. The bare essentials were all subsidized. You get broaching for 3 pennies.
I think a big part of the breakdown there was the fact that it was government imposed.
It was government imposed, and people took it for granted.
Yeah.
You know, and if I couldn't work harder and get ahead, why bother working harder?
Well, on such a massive scale for everyone, you know, if we all made $10,000 left to give it away to the people in the nation, then that all would have to be government imposed to work, and then you're back in the same situation.
Yeah, no, I don't want us to work less and make $10,000 less to give it away. You know, what I'm talking about is working less so that someone else can work.
I don't understand.
Well, let's assume that there's a given amount of work to be done in a plant or in an office, and it's going to take 120 work hours a week to get it done. All right. That the three of us work 40 hours a week to work those 120 work hours to make a certain salary. I mean, there's also so much to be paid for the work. We don't work less and give the money away and let the work go undone. We say, I'll work 10 hours less. Each of us works. How many? 13 hours? Thank you. 13 hours less, and somebody else comes in and works for 27 hours.
Or more personal level, so many two-income homes now, is the second wage earner working for the fluff or really for survival? And could you give up that job? You know, the second wage earner, could you stay home and let someone else? I teach, and people are clamoring for more teaching points. and you know, so many people are all trying to grab them to get them. Or are we really depriving someone who needs that as the sole reason? Greedy. Mm-hmm. We're greedy.
Yeah.
Well, this is the Bible telling us exactly her answer to it, you know, to give what you have. If it doesn't come from the heart, I think it doesn't work. And that's what I looked at in East Germany all these years, that it was enforced by the government. And so it's important people didn't work harder. But if I work harder to get more money so that I can give things away, my pastor said to me, are you rich? You know, because I had given something, and she didn't know where I got the money. Oh, it isn't that I'm rich, it's that that's what I choose to do with my money instead of buying another coat, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's what we're charged as Christians, that we make the system work as a response to God's love. God's love to us, not a response to the government enforcement.
Yeah. I think that's in response to God's love for us. The way I said this in the first Bible study, I got some people upset because I talked about this being a part of salvation. And I want to make it clear that this is giving that comes out of salvation, not giving that leads to salvation. But the two run together. One's not complete without the other. You had a comment or a question you want to make?
No. Suppose now that you had a country where everybody made the same wage, everybody's earning $20,000 a year. Those people would not all live at the same level on making the same amount. Some have the gift for managing money better than others.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't equalize. And you can't feel guilty because you have one coat and someone else has no coat. If you see someone with a need, yes, you have to share. But it isn't always going to stay equal.
Yeah, I'm not talking at all about feeling guilty about it. I'm saying make sure that no one is cold at night. That we are charged with. And no feeling guilty or not guilty about it. It's just you see somebody who needs, and you have to make sure that they have what they need. Some of you heard Paul Hansen talking about the year of the Jubilee, and if you didn't hear the explanation for that, it's an Israelite tradition that we don't know was ever put into practice. We don't have any reference that says King Hezekiah or King Josiah or any king came upon the throne in the seventh year after the Jubilee, or in his second year was the year of the Jubilee. But it was a Sabbath of Sabbath. Every seven times 7 years, and then in the 50th year, everything was equalized. Everybody came into the nation with the nation, into the land, with the land being a gift from God. And the plan was that every family, so this family over here gets a portion, and this family over here gets a portion, and this family over here gets a portion. And it was inalienable. It always belonged to that family. Which is, there are already problems in this system because the more prolific producers of offspring had more ways to divide the pie. But it meant that nobody in the Israelite tradition, except for the Levites who were a special class, were without land, which was the means of production, the means of making a living. You could sell it. I could sell my inheritance. I could sell it to you. I want something you had. You were a better manager. I wanted it. I bought it from you. You have my land. I bought it from you with my land. But 50 years in the 50th year, you were obliged to release the land, and it goes back to my family, to my offspring. So there is an intent in the covenantal community to make sure that people always have a means of making a living. And if we deny that to anyone, and if, what is the means of making a living in this country?
Work.
And now that we're less and less a manufacturing community?
Education.
Is there anybody here who goes to work not on the basis of their education? So we go back to this kid sitting with me, sitting in this chair. Say he's not my kid. So he can go to any school. My kid's going to go to a good school. my kid's going to go to a good school because that's how you get a chance to make some money and feed your family, have access to everything in between. But he can go to inner city public schools. Or if he drops out, that's, you know, fine. He never makes it to school because no one puts an emphasis on that. Schools can be very different. We do have two different educational systems, even within the public schools in the state of Illinois. It is amazing the gap between the schools in the neighborhood that I am fortunate to live in right now and the schools in the neighborhood that I used to live in, and what the kids will learn in school, what the expectations of these children are, kindergarten through high school. And that's only in the public schools. When you go to private schools, it's another matter, and you go to the universities, it's yet another matter. Question or comment? You've been trying to say something.
Well, I just want to comment. I think the redistribution of property in a significant way, or even what we were talking about just a moment ago in terms of talking about giving up jobs for other people. Okay, but I'm just saying, in general, that the tenor of that discussion, it seems to me, is enormously problematic. But what you've just hit on, it seems to me, is a very real possibility and a very real tragedy in this country in terms of the problems of education and the problems of healthcare, because it seems to me in the late 20th century and through the 21st century, it is those societies that do provide adequate education or more than adequate education that will allow the society to be competitive on worldwide scales. We're already seeing the problems, even quote unquote among the educated class, comparatively speaking to Japanese culture or other cultures that have school children going 220 days versus 180 days, or the terrible mathematics skills, or what it takes essentially to continue to make the society productive. And as we go to a society that's increasingly split between the haves and the have-nots, we're in terrible danger, even those that have, of essentially creating again a condition where we're simply not going to be able to have anything to distribute in any meaningful sense to, let alone our own society, the rest of the world. So again, I guess I say education, housing, healthcare, you know, is the critical infrastructure that the society needs to address, and that most of us in the middle and the upper middle class are again refusing to address. It comes up for every tax issue that comes up in my community right now is jeopardized because people believe themselves already to be taxed. But the student-teacher ratio in our school district is very bad.
But the issues that you point out there are the very issues that even on a purely economic picture of salvation illustrate that if we regard it as our own and refuse to give it away, to receive it as a gift or a loan and refuse to give it away, it comes back. It may not come back in my lifetime, but it's certainly going to come back in the lifetime of this nation to just eat us up so that it just collapses upon itself. Yeah.
It's when Jesus commented in the Sermon on the Mount, seek first the kingdom of God and then all these things will be added. Does that have any bearing in some of this conversation about redistribution and is that where part of our problem is that as a world we are not seeking first God's kingdom?
I'll say yes with a caveat, and the caveat is I think Jesus was a Jew. I think he was well educated in the prophets and in the writings and in the Torah, and that the center is always proper worship. But proper worship that doesn't bear fruits isn't proper. The right form that doesn't bear fruit is not proper worship. And let me try to illustrate two things with these two. Well, let's go to the Amos passage first and illustrate two things. One, this point right here about where worship should lead. That'll be in Amos 6, actually, but 1:1. Who are these people speaking? Who are these voices in the wilderness? Is the other part that I want to get to, and we're almost out of time, so I got to get at this. We have a tendency to think that these voices in the wilderness, and John the Baptist is sort of iffy because he does come, as we heard, come from a priestly family, but he ends up out on the edge of society. And I want to point to two places, two edges of society that we absolutely need to listen to. Someone got Amos 1:1.
The words of Amos, one of the shepherds of Tekoa, what he saw concerning Israel 2 years before the earthquake, when Uzziah was king of Judah and Jeroboam, son of Joash, was king of Israel.
Okay. Amos, if you don't know this already, is one of the very central 8th century prophets. What did he do for a living?
The shepherd.
He was basically your guy off the street. Now, some people want to romanticize this farmer and say he was a dumb farmer. Well, everybody in Israel was a dumb farmer. I mean, most everybody in Israel was a dumb farmer by our standards. The only farmer that I know personally, he's a fairly good friend, has a BA in science and chemistry, and used to fix jets for the Air Force. He was a jet mechanic. So this guy is not dumb by any stretch of the imagination. I don't want anybody to think that I think farmers are dumb. But he was basically your guy off the street. Today we could slap in there, I was an MBA from here, or I was a grocery store clerk, or basically your person off the street. What everyday people do, that's what Amos did. This is the superscription, so this is a later piece, but let's go to 7:14. And while you're moving to 7:14, I'll remind you that this is his response to a priest of the northern kingdom from the king's sanctuary. And this is what he tells him, prophet, go home and prophesy in your own land. And Amos' response is, somebody got 7:14 for me?
Then Amos answered Amaziah, I am no prophet nor a prophet's son, but I am a herdsman and a dresser of sycamore trees.
Okay. Again, guy off the street. Someone look across the page to 6, and chapter 6, and let me just see. Just start reading, and I'll tell you when we've gone far enough to hear what Amos is prophesying against. Amos has prophesied against the realm of the northern kingdom, and let's see what was going on in the northern kingdom. Go ahead.
Woe to those who are at ease in Zion, and to those who feel secure on the mountain of Samaria, the notable men of the first of the nations to whom the house of Israel come. Pass over to Chaldea and see, and thence go to Ham the Great, then go down to Gath of the Philistines. Are they better than these kingdoms, or is their territory greater than your territory? O you who put far away the evil day and bring near the seat of violence. Woe to those who lie upon beds of ivory and stretch themselves upon their couches and eat lambs from the flock and calves from the midst of the stall, who sing idle songs to the sound of the harp, and like David invent for themselves instruments of music, who drink wine and bowl and anoint themselves with the finest oils, but are not grieved over the ruin of Joseph.
Great, that's far enough. What are these people doing that Amos is talking about?
They're living in luxury.
Living in luxury on ivory beds. Yeah, Egyptian import items. Not that imports are bad, but they're signs of more than we need. And I, you know, again, I got to look at my Sony and say, do I need that CD player? But that's the kind of important thing. And where did we end up? They're living in luxury, and what are they unconcerned about? The ruin of Joseph. The demise of one of their brothers. Something that there's been a natural disaster. Probably the earthquake that we heard about in 1:1. And no one is concerned about it. I've got my bowl of wine and my bed of ivory and my lamb and my songs, and so I'm okay. Guy off the street sees this. You know? understands that this is a problem and points it out. Not someone from the priesthood in this case, and not someone from the especially well-educated class. Not your PhD, not your pastor telling the story, but a lay person. Let's look at Jeremiah 1:6. This is another segment of the population that we tend to discount. Some Jeremiah's call, and he's told what he's going to do, and then this is his response. Someone go ahead for me.
Then I said, Ah, Lord God, behold, I do not know how to speak, for I am only a youth.
Okay. But the Lord said to me, do not say I'm only a youth, for all to whom I send you shall soon. You know, age isn't a problem here, folks. I picked at youth because it's one of the parts of the society that we tend to tell to wait until you know something. Knowing something isn't the answer, but being able to see injustice, being able to understand what some common sense what you need is what this is all about. And on the other end of it, age isn't the answer, although that's not the example here. You know, being old doesn't stop you from doing something. Unfortunately, and it grieves me to say this, being a priest or being an academic, being somebody who should know better, often puts you in a position not to do something. And so basically what I'm saying here is don't wait for us to be the leaders. There's example after example after example in this book of people who are going to be told by the priest to shut up, to go home, who make the difference, who speak the word of God. So, thanks for your time and your attention.